And welcome to Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan. My guest today is Greg Braden, and we're going to be talking for the first half hour of our program about basically the divine matrix. Greg Braden's my guest. I've had him on a number of times in the past, and we're going to be talking not only about the divine matrix, but how metaphysics has played a role in his life, spirituality, those various elements, and how he came from a very logical aspect to other issues. Stay with us. And that is what we do here. Talk and walk and try to understand one another. That's what it's all about. And Greg Braden, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program. It's a pleasure to have you live here in Santa Barbara here on the 15th of September. It's 11 o'clock in the morning here. It's you're in New Mexico, I believe it is, and it's a little later there, but it's just a pleasure to talk with you again.
Oh, I'm definitely live here today, and I am talking to you, Richard, from the beautiful blue sky, high desert of northern New Mexico. And I'm just thrilled to be on the program. It's great to hear your voice, and I'm excited to talk about what we're going to talk about today.
Well, you have you've been a busy guy, to say the very least, in terms of your research and all of the various things that you have done over the years, not only going back as early as the 1970s and into the 80s into very highly technical fields, computers and defense programs and those different things, and then suddenly, probably for you, not out of the blue, you decided, I'm going to take a different tack. I'm going to do some research in another area that may hold a little bit more meaning for not only myself, but maybe the rest of humanity. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, it is to some degree, Richard. You know, what's interesting, I have never made a distinction between science and spirituality, even as a child. I just had this conversation with my mom over a meal not long ago, and she reminded me that when I was 4 and 5 years old, that she was supporting me in my interests, and my interests at that time were the sciences. When we studied chemistry and biology and geology and physics and astronomy and all those things, and I always believed, and I remember believing at the time, when we understand those things, we understand our world, our relationship to our world, to one another, ultimately, what we're doing is understanding our relationship to a greater existence. But I just thought that everyone believed the same way, even though no one talked about it. And it wasn't until I got into the corporations where I found nothing could be further from the truth, that there was a belief that if you're following the path of science, that excludes the path of spirituality, that the two were somehow mutually exclusive. And it was an awakening for me. It was just an assumption. I thought everybody believed as I did and just didn't talk about it. So it was during the my corporate career, at the end of the Cold War, working in the defense industry, when I did make a conscious choice to leave that industry and pursue this what some people call spirituality or a spiritual blend of science and spirituality, with the intent of finding unifying principles that would apply to every human on the face of the earth, in the hopes that once those principles were understood, maybe we could find reasons to avoid the kind of wars such as the Cold War and others that we found ourselves in the 20th century. So that's a long answer to a short question that you've asked there.
Well, and I also used to think, too, that it was enough that we were all human, and that if we were cut in any way, shape, or form, we bled the same red blood. Mm-hmm. And I thought that that was enough that would bind us together. But apparently that isn't the case. And I guess humans need something a little bit more, I don't know, profound?
Well, I think we do now. You know, I was born and raised in a relatively conservative community in the Midwest, in northern Missouri. And it was just kind of an unspoken, there were a lot of unspoken things that people sort of took for granted, or they made assumptions about common beliefs that it was suspected that we all held. And over the years, as I've gone back into that part of the world and done the programs that we're doing now based on the books we're talking about now, what I found is, again, nothing can be further from the truth. There are a number of people throughout the world, not just in the Midwest of our country, but who still believe that that there are differences between us that are so great that it justifies one segment of the population living on the earth and another segment of the population not deserving to live on the earth. And it's a very, very different way of thinking about things from what the principles of our past have always taught.
When you began the process, and I'm only going to go back as far as, say, the God Code, but I know this goes back to the beginning of the writings, which you have so many of them, and one of the most recent that I happen to be looking at, I believe, was Spontaneous Healing of Our Beliefs, and it kind of ties into what you're talking about, but it seems as though with the God Code, as we talked some years ago, I think I got enough of a glimpse of what you were sharing, and that is that there is something within the DNA, an alphanumeric code, that binds all of us as human beings. This goes beyond the red blood cells. This is something that is there. It's not in any animals, is it?
Well, Richard, this is actually part of two things. First of all, you mentioned the Spontaneous Healing of Belief.
Mm-hmm.
That book, this is a secret that just you and me and our listeners now, that book has not yet been released. It'll be, it's available April, through Hay House. It's still in the works right now. There's a recording based on that, maybe mm-hmm. what you're seeing, but
yes.
The book itself is not available yet. And all of this work, including the God Code, was all intended to illuminate unifying principles that will help us transcend the differences of our past. The God Code is a project that began over 25 years ago, and it's ongoing. It's not complete. Part of my job and my training, when I was working in the defense industry, I worked in an area of software development called pattern recognition, which the name pretty much says it all. Developing software to find patterns in codes. The first time I saw the human genome come across my CRT screen, my computer screen, back in the 1980s, I said, "Wow, I don't know what it says, but I just had an intuitive sense that there was a message that was a code." And of course, we didn't know then what we know now, and these last 25 years have been used to marry the best science of our time with the wisdom and the instructions of 5,000-year-old texts, to help us understand what that code actually says. And the God Code was sort of a jump point saying this is what we found so far. And what it told us was that literally, this isn't a metaphor, there's a literal message encoded into the DNA of all life, including human every cell in every human body. And when we translate that message from the chemical codes into the alphabetic codes, it literally reads the words God eternal within the body. And it says so in every strand of DNA that we have. Over the 50 trillion cells in our bodies, each of us has 50 trillion copies of the message God eternal within the body, and we have for several hundred thousand years now. So we don't know who put that message there, why it's there. We could do a whole program on what this is, but it implies, number one, that we are not a fluke or an accident of nature, that there's an intentionality.
But you've also found out, too, in your research, that this also transcends the languages, most every language, too.
Well, you find this message when we translate the chemistry of DNA into the languages. It only appears to work, Richard, in what are called the core or the root or the original alphabets of human existence, such as ancient Sanskrit, ancient Arabic, and ancient Hebrew. And from those, we can then translate into the more modern languages so that we can actually read them like English. But English is not considered to be a core or a root language.
Mm-hmm.
So it implies, because that message is there, and it's there in every human that walks the earth, no matter what they believe or how they have chosen to live their lives, it is truly a message of unity saying that we are a family. And it's the first time, I believe, we've had a really tangible way to grasp that message. There's much more that is hidden, much more code hidden in the DNA, and that is an ongoing project. And I think once we are able to reveal that, and then hopefully that's coming down the road relatively soon, I think you're going to see this message everywhere. I mean, it's this is a huge, it blows the whole concept of are we alone right out of the water, because if we've got a message in our DNA and it's in the simplest forms, the earliest records of our DNA, it means a greater power or a higher existence put it there a long time ago. And there's a whole conversation. Who put that message there? Why is it there? And why is it taking us so long to be able to read it?
Well, there's a poem that I read some time ago that sort of goes along the same lines. Basically, the gods, plural, basically were trying to figure out where they could hide their message to man. And then, of course, they went through the litany of places on the mountaintops and deep sea and this place and that place. And, of course, every time they would mention this, one of the other gods would say, well, but no, they'll find it because they'll find a way to get there, here, there, everywhere, out in outer space and so forth. And then they thought, let's hide it in their hearts. They'll never look there. Well, they'll never look in the DNA either until now.
So, Richard, I'm just asking, do you remember what poem that was or where you read that?
I'll have to get that to you. I have it at home in a study group workbook, and it was a fascinating poem because it really does, it's much more lengthy, and I'm trying to keep it brief. But that's kind of the bottom line, is that's where it seems as though those tiny little places that we would never think to look, whether it be the heart or what have you, always we seem to find the most profound pieces of information. Well, and in this case, the DNA is pretty darn tiny.
It is. Well, you know, Richard, when I was trained as an engineer, I was trained as a scientist working in the defense industry back in the 1980s, and I began looking into these ancient texts, some of our most cherished ancient and spiritual traditions, and then journeying into the parts of the world where these texts originated to talk to the people and the cultures that remain today, and that the bottom line, everything they said was look within, and that's where you're going to find the answers. And the text said, seek within and you shall find, look to yourself, all that you seek shall be revealed. And everyone kept saying, well, you know, it's a nice metaphor. And so many times in the past, what we find in the ancient traditions, they didn't think about using metaphors. When they wrote something, they meant it. And I just asked the question, I said, could that be true in the case to understand who we are? Could it be that these are literal instructions? And if they are, what are the next instructions? Mm-hmm. And what I found was a 5,000-year-old Hebrew text that told us how to look within in the language of another time, and married that with the best science of today to begin exploring DNA in a very novel way. Mm-hmm. And it's an ongoing. We have a virtual team of scientists from different parts of the world that are working as we speak, and I'm excited, and I'd love to come on your program and share what we find next. But
well, I would love to have you back as a regular to share these ideas. I want to let our listeners know that, and Greg, if you're open to this, we'd like to maybe open up the phone lines for people who might have questions in regards to some of the research that you've done and some of the things we've talked about.
I'm sure open to it. I'd like to talk about it before we do.
Absolutely.
I'd like to have maybe a few minutes to talk about the Divine Matrix.
And exactly.
Absolutely. That's where the good stuff comes from when the questions come across. It'd invite me to answer, you know, in a way that may not be in the book.
Exactly. And I will let our listeners know we'll be opening the phone lines up shortly. But first, we do want to chat a little bit more about the Divine Matrix. And if you would like to give us a call when we open the lines up, the number will be 879-5478, 879-KIST. And you can ask Greg questions in regards to how maybe he got involved, if we haven't already addressed that, or just questions that have come into your mind. And I think that's kind of an interesting place to start. The questions that come to our minds, came to your mind, Greg, where do you think some of these concepts for trying to figure out what is the Divine Matrix and the God Code came from? I mean, you've already made it fairly clear that somebody put that message in the DNA. Mm-hmm. It wasn't you and it wasn't me.
Right.
So what's your speculation as to where some of this stuff comes from?
Well, intuitively, a lot of this has come to me. The ideas were intuitive ideas, but as a scientist, I was trained to look in the world around me. And what I began to find very quickly, Richard, this is back in the 70s and 80s, was that other cultures look at our existence, our origins, our creation and our role in the universe very, very differently than we do. And when I say we, I mean we in the West, typically of the Judeo-Christian traditions. So my next question was, why? Why would, you know, if we're in the same world and we have the same history, why would we look at things so differently? And what I began to find was that what we believe about ourselves and our world, much of it comes from what has been written and handed down to us from our past. And when I began to understand that, I said, well, you know, where does that information come from? And what we know is there's a lineage of wisdom that links our modern world with our past. And as different as the different religions and spiritual traditions appear to be, they can pretty much be traced back to this common body of knowledge and wisdom. And what makes that so interesting is that in our case, in the case of Judeo-Christian traditions, our chain of wisdom was broken at least twice in recorded history, and each time it was broken, we lost big pieces of information, huge concepts that other cultures didn't lose. So with the burning of the Great Library of Alexandria in the 4th century B.C., when 536,000 documents were destroyed, and with the biblical edits in the 4th century A.D., when 45 books were edited, 20 books were removed completely, another 25 were condensed and rearranged. Put all that together, and it's easy to see how we could have lost some really important concepts about who we are. And now that many of those documents are being recovered in places like the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi Library of Egypt and the Coptic and Gnostic libraries and things like that, we're finding the original texts that were lost. And what we're finding, Richard, is that we have what can be considered the Reader's Digest condensed version of a much greater, broader history with much deeper explanation in other traditions that were lost in our own. And so as I began to explore those traditions and look at how science was either validating or not validating them, that became the impetus to do what I'm doing right now. But I just, one of the last things, you know, at the last years of the Cold War, a very frightening time in the history of our world, and we now are arguably in a pivotal crossroads in human history where the best minds of our time are telling us we've got to figure out how to do this thing, how to live in this world without destroying it, without having wars to solve our problems, how to deal with the diseases that are cropping up all over the world we've never seen before. And they're saying we need new, innovative ways to think of ourselves and our world to solve these problems. And that's why I'm so excited about this information, because I think it does just that.
I find it fascinating myself because it will hopefully give a little more insight not only into myself but my fellow human beings and alleviate some of the stress and strife that I might feel as I'm traveling down life's highway when people want to do what it is they want to do. I say, wait a minute, that person is just like me, you know, and I've got to treat that person with the respect that I would hope they would treat me with. It doesn't matter how bad his day's been or her day or my day. We have got to find ways to get along. And I used to think that if it were possible, and I do believe that if this were the way it was supposed to be, there are certainly enough planets in the universe for every single one of us on this planet to occupy an individual planet and live solo. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? That isn't the way it's designed, because guess what? We're all here on the same planet.
That wouldn't be any fun at all, would it?
Well, it wouldn't. It wouldn't be any fun, certainly. But it's also a situation where we're all here together. So that must mean that for some reason, we are all here together.
Well, we are here together, and what the new book, The Divine Matrix, is showing us that togetherness may be even greater and run even deeper than we've believed in the past. Because what Western science is now validating. Western science has just arrived at the understandings where many of these ancient spiritual traditions begin. So Western science and then the last years of the 20th and now the 21st century are now validating the fact, and it is now a fact, that we are bathed in a field of intelligent energy that connects everything in ways we're only beginning to understand. We've spent thousands of years in science, the last 300 years, trying to validate whether or not this field is there. And these other traditions that we're talking about, the indigenous traditions of the Aboriginals or Native North or South Americans or the Hindus or many of the Buddhist traditions, this is the place where they began,
yeah.
Richard. So they started there, and they've spent the last few hundred years exploring what this field means and how we apply it in our lives. And that's, for me, the value of marrying the best science of our time with the wisdom of our past into a greater understanding of ourselves that we can apply to the challenges that we find ourselves faced with today.
Well, let's talk about the divine matrix. I'm going to speculate that it is not something tangible. It is more esoteric than that, but it is something that we are all a part of. Many people, of course, have seen, I'm sure, the movie The Matrix and its spin-offs and so forth. And obviously there are two worlds, one in which the Matrix, in which, you know, we are living and breathing and doing our thing. And then there's an outer world, which is the real reality. And without going any further, tell us about the divine matrix. What is it made of, and where does it take us?
It has esoteric implications,
okay.
But it is actually a measurable field. And this is one of the mysteries. Why did it take us so long to find it? It's because it is made of what is called a non-conventional or unconventional form of energy. You can't measure it the way you do a broadcast radio or a television wave on the one hand, and on the other hand, it's this field that is the stuff where everything comes from. The rocks, the trees, the plants, you and me, the situations, the circumstances that we find ourselves in relationships, in careers, abundance, health. In short, our lives and our world originate from the quantum essence of this deeper field. In 1944, the father of quantum theory, his name was Max Planck, actually made a statement that was amazing. Today it's amazing, and in his time, I think it probably wasn't really even understood. What he said was, what we see is matter doesn't really exist. He said that underlying everything we see, there is what he called the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind that is the matrix of all matter. And he's the one that coined that term. And of course, the movie series came along just a few years ago, was based upon the work from Max Planck back in the 1940s. But it's this deeper unseen realm that everything, it's the origins of where everything began. And this is precisely what ancient traditions have always said, is that we're living in a shadow reality that's actually the projection of something more real. We just can't see it from where we are. They say that we're living in a dream or an illusion. I know we've all heard that before.
Especially from the Hindu traditions, the Maya, I believe it is. That's not the correct word.
Mahayana, Buddhist traditions,
yes,
talk about this, as well as the Hindu traditions. Both of them do, absolutely, and the Aboriginals.
And it reminds me of if I may delve into the science fiction a little bit, it reminds me of the holodecks in Star Trek and the Enterprise series. I remember one series where they had a whole adventure, blah, 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 and they managed to end this particular episode by capturing or encapsulating these individuals that they were dealing with. Inside this small, maybe 1 foot square box, and Data just kind of looks up in the air somewhere and says, "Computer, end program," thinking that if we could trick this individual into believing that they were in a real world, and actually now they're existing in a box, then isn't it possibly within the realms of possibility that maybe we're living inside a box too?
Well, you know, this the very idea that you're talking about, first of all, it's not part of the Divine Matrix book, and I just want our listeners to know that, and
mm-hmm.
we have explored it in other writings and other programs, live seminars. There's a growing body of scientific consensus, mainstream scientists and engineers. These aren't guys sitting on a park bench feeding pigeons looking for something to explore. These are brilliant young physicists, engineers at MIT and some of the big universities in other countries are now using the language that you've just described, Richard, and they're saying there's a very real possibility that what the ancients have always called the dream that we're living in, or the illusion that we're living in. This is the language in 2, 3, 4, 5,000-year-old texts. The scientists are saying the same thing. They're saying that we may very possibly be living in a virtual or a simulated reality that has been going on for a very long time, and that the real us is outside of this reality working somewhere else, which doesn't sound so much different from what the religions have always told us, that we're in these bodies, but our souls or our spirits originate somewhere else, and they're part of a greater existence. And when you start thinking about these possibilities, you say, you know, why would we do something like this? And we need look no further than the definition of a virtual reality or a simulation, maybe to give us a clue, because the definition says that a virtual reality is a computer-generated experience that's designed so that we can learn the rules of one way of being in a relatively safe environment before we actually get into the place where we need to use those rules. Again, we compare this to the ancient spiritual and religious traditions. We're told that we're preparing in this world to learn how to be in another world, to use our hearts and the power of thought, feeling, emotion, and belief. And whether we believe that these are real descriptions or if we use them just as a metaphor, either way, this idea is powerful because it gives us a language and a vehicle to have these kinds of conversations, and it takes it out of the realm of pure speculation, because the scientists are actually running mathematics simulations and proofs trying to determine whether or not we're living in a world that's real or we're living in a world that is somehow being fabricated or simulated by another intelligence. And I'll just tell you the bottom line, what the MIT theses are saying, that the people that have spent years of their lives exploring this, when they do the statistical analysis, Richard, the odds are greater that we are living in a simulated reality than are not. And that just opens up the door to a whole realm of possibilities.
And it actually takes us to the core of this program. Tell Me Your Story is designed to give you, the listener, and hopefully myself and even Greg, you, new choices and new knowledge. Give you choices and knowledge to go places that maybe you never thought you could. And so what you've just shared with us, Greg, opens up the possibility in thought to start with, that if in fact we are living in a virtual reality, a simulated reality, and let's say we are our true selves, are on the outside looking in, then it almost stands to reason, and I want to have you elaborate, the possibility is there that things are not as concrete as we might think they are, and that we could conceivably change our present and future almost at will.
Absolutely. Whether the whole discussion on simulated virtual reality, this was it's not in the book The Divine Matrix. It's something you and I just touched upon in this program. However, it ties into the fundamental premise that is the Divine Matrix, and that is that there's a field of energy that bathes all of creation. It's not out there somewhere. It's passing through your body and my body and our listeners' bodies right now. Every atom of every cell within us right now is emerging from this deeper reality, and it's emerging and reemerging. We are literally being reborn, giving new birth to ourselves from this virtual or this deeper reality every moment of our lives. Where this becomes important, science acknowledges now, it's a fact, the field's there. Bottom line, we know the field's there, number one. Number two, where this gets really relevant is science has also now acknowledged, and we talk about the research in the book The Divine Matrix, that we all speak a language that communicates with this field in ways that can bring joy and abundance and healing and peace to our relationships, our careers, to our bodies, or we can also do just the opposite of all those things if we're not aware of how this language works. It's a language of no words, a nonverbal language based in human belief, human emotion, human feeling that is centered in our hearts. This is not what happens in our brain, in our mind. This is about feeling. It's about feeling as if our prayers are already answered, feeling as if our healing has already happened, feeling as if we're already successful in our careers and relationships, because that feeling that we have is what this field conforms to. Our feelings become the seeds of the blueprints that the field will mirror back to us, and this is the way many other cultures have always seen our world, and this is very, very new for our Western minds and for Western science to think about the world in this way.
It may take some time for the Western brain to wrap itself around that. And as we continue to move forward, I want to let our listeners know you're listening to Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan. My guest is Greg Braden, the author of many books, including the one we're discussing now, The Divine Matrix. I also want to let you know about next week's program, which kind of ties in with what we're talking about. My guest next week is going to be Frederick Elias, Ph.D. He's written a book called I Can, I Will. Basically, you'll be able to determine your destination. You'll overcome barriers to success. You'll increase your self-confidence, and you'll also learn how to successfully manage your emotions, which sort of ties into what you're talking about as far as emotions. And I was actually reading a quote, Greg, from your book, The Divine Matrix, which is bridging time, space, miracles, and belief. New discoveries suggest that our world is the mirror of our beliefs, folks. What we once believed is about to change, and of course the Western mind, that's a hard one. But I was reading something here. It was basically from, if I may, from chapter 6. It's the universe is talking to us and messages from the Matrix. And this particular quote says that when love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undistinguished. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. And that is from a 6th century philosopher. Is it Sheng Tsang?
Sheng Tsang is precisely who it was, and I think it's so powerful. Those words are just as relevant today as they were when they were written, and I just can't imagine to a largely illiterate population in the 6th century, when a man far ahead of his time would say something like that, what it would have meant to them. Because even today, I mean, you talk to a highly educated person on the street and you tell them that there's that fine line in our reality that's based in the way we feel about our world. And there's a big disconnect. It doesn't make a lot of sense to many people in our world. So, you know, all of this, it can sound very technical. It can sound very scientific, Richard, and the science is certainly there to substantiate and validate what we're talking about, and that's what I've done in this book. But the bottom line is we don't have to know any of that to make use of this field in our lives, and this is what our most cherished spiritual traditions have always said. If we were going to end the interview right now, and you ask me to sum up in one sentence, that sentence would be that the way this field works is we must become in our lives the things that we choose to experience in our world. And that's a huge statement. I think about this a lot. If we want nurturing and love, healing in our lives, if we want that to be the physical reality, because it's coming from the field, we've got to give that field something to work with, a blueprint, so it can give that back to us. So we must feel the feelings as if we're already healed, because we all are healed to some degree. We're not fooling ourselves, and this isn't, we're not lying to ourselves if we feel the feeling as if we or our loved ones are already healed, because some part of us is always healed. And when we give thanks of gratitude and appreciation for the healing that's already present, what we do is we open the door and set into motion the events for greater amounts of that healing to come to us. And the same with peace at the family dinner table or abundance, either spiritual or material abundance in our lives, nurturing relationships, success in our careers. Everything that we know and experience in life begins in this field. And everything that we experience is being mirrored back to us as a result of something that we believe in this moment, whether we are conscious or unconsciously aware of it. And that's the key. If if life is showing us a lot of nasty things, we're saying, you know, what in the world's going on? We may want to take a look at beliefs, sometimes unconscious beliefs, that have been patterned or imprinted into us from the time we were children, or by our families, or our society, or our culture, and that may be a lot of the implications of these things are that we're all experiencing beliefs that aren't even ours. They come from the conditioning of our families and our society, and most of those are based in fear.
I find it interesting that you say that, because years ago I interviewed a Christian musician who had written a book on those lines. He grew up in the Jesus movement of the 60s and early 70s as a kid, moved to New England in the in the 80s, early 90s, wrote this book, and we were chatting, and he says, yeah, I moved to New England because I needed to find out if the beliefs that I believed were mine or what I was told I was supposed to believe.
Wow, what a powerful man. Just to even have the awareness to question what it was that he had been taught and what he was actually believing. But you know, I've done interviews all day today. This is an interview week. They come hour after hour while I'm at one phone in one time zone. And this topic is one that has come up a lot in the last couple of days. So it obviously is up for a lot of people. But, you know, when you think about our beliefs, I mean, when we're children, for example, I mean, these are facts. So we're children, we are born into this world knowing how to swim. All mammals know how to swim at birth. We can give, and there are people that give underwater births, either in the ocean or in water tanks in their homes, and the baby, we come out of the womb knowing how to swim, until we're about 4 years old, and then something begins to happen, and all of a sudden we become afraid of the water, we become afraid of the dark, we become afraid of being alone. And you have to ask, what is it that happens during that time? Well, we know that the brain development around the age of 4 years old, this is when our brains, our cognitive centers are developing, and we begin to tune in to the beliefs, the field of information, if you will, that holds the beliefs of all of those before us, of our family, of our society, of our culture. And suddenly we begin to take on those beliefs. We think we can't swim, even though we did when we were born. We think that the dark is a scary place, even though we may not have had any frightening experiences in the dark, or that if we're suddenly alone, I mean, why would we be afraid to be alone if we've never had an experience of something bad happening in our loneliness? It's fascinating, and we begin to ask the question, when we have the great fears in our lives, how much of those fears are really ours, or are we living our lives based in the experiences of other people, individually and collectively, like the musician was asking that question? And if we are, what does it take for us to wake up from that conditioning and to transcend those fears? And that can be a lifetime worth of work.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you put it that way, because the thought has occurred to me from time to time that if it's possible, and obviously it is very possible, that we pass on to our children and their children the physical characteristics, hey, he's got your mother's eyes and your Uncle Fred's ears and so on and so forth, then why is it so far out of the realms of possibility that we don't pass on not only the mental, emotional, but even the spiritual aspects of our ancestors?
Well,
and those other things you were talking about too, the pre-programmed stuff.
Well, it depends on who you're speaking with. In some circles, not only is it not out of the realm of possibility, it's accepted as the way things are. One of the things that the new research is showing, and I think I did talk about this in the Divine Matrix, is we're beginning to look at memory and the way our brains work very, very differently from the way we have in the past. I remember back in the 70s, I had the opportunity to see part of Albert Einstein's brain. It's thin sectioned in a jar. Now I believe it's in the University of Kansas somewhere. And at his death, the researchers took his brain, and they wanted to study it. They wanted to see what made him so different from everyone else. And what they found was his brain looked pretty much just like everybody else's brain. It had a few more folds in it, but giving it more surface area. But other than that, it looked pretty much like everyone else's. And one of the things that now in the early 21st century, scientists are beginning to understand that memory is information that is not totally stored in the physical brain itself. Our physical brain creates the antenna, the neural networks that tune to the information that's held in this field of the divine matrix.
And in some traditions, they call that the Akashic Record.
There are many different names for how this information is held, but the key is that our information doesn't live within us, that we create the antenna, if you will, in our brains that tune to where that information lives. And what it means is there really are no secrets. And this fact, what I'm saying is so real that the United States military has actually used this in wartime situations like the first Gulf War, in projects that involved phenomenon like remote viewing. You may have had remote viewing guests on your program in the past, but it's remote viewing is a skill that can be developed where an individual sits in one room, you know, somewhere in Virginia, closes their eyes, and goes into an altered state, and in consciousness, they're able to see and hear and sometimes smell events that are happening halfway around the world, such as in the battlefield of Iraq. So the first Gulf War, people were trained and utilized to remote view the Scud missile locations in the Iraqi deserts and find the actual XY coordinates without sending anyone in there to find them. So we didn't risk our troops' lives, but we knew where these missiles were. And the only reason I'm sharing this as an example is this is how real the field is. We couldn't use it this way if it were not a real, tangible, concrete essence that stores information and allows us to travel in consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
It means that we're not limited the way we've been led to believe in the past.
Well, I've heard stories about during the Cold War, the Soviet Union, their government was using psychic abilities amongst their people to try to do similar kinds of things regarding us and their other enemies.
Sure. Well, the Soviets have been years, they're decades ahead of us. They mm-hmm. were doing experiments with telepathy and the kinds of things we're talking about during the 60s. With their cosmonauts and their first spacecraft, and we kind of blew it off. We just didn't take it seriously because, and a lot of it goes back to our conditioning. We lost the texts that tell us how we work in this universe in the 4th century AD when tremendous amounts of information were lost in our biblical texts. And so people say, well, what does that have to do with modern science? The science simply validates what it is that we've come to understand about our world. And because we have been led to believe that we're separate from everything else, the science really wasn't applied to show us anything different. And it's only relatively recently with the explorations in quantum physics, when we look at ourselves and the world as energy, pure energy, it's pretty hard to tell where we end and where the rest of the world begins because that line gets really fuzzy. And that is a very different way for the Western mind to think about these things.
It is indeed. And I'd like for our listeners to think about this. There are websites you can go to get further information, both about Greg Braden and also about this interview and other future programs. My website is richarddugan.com. That's Richard Dugan, DUGAN.com. You can also go to, I love this now, we all have .coms, Greg. GregBraden.com. And you can find out about all of the various things that he's written about, further information, seminars, workshops. As a matter of fact, my understanding is this is your last day for interviews. You are headed off for an international conference, and you'll be doing some talking and discussing about a lot of these and related subjects as well. It would be fascinating one day to have you, if you're ever in the Santa Barbara area, have you in studio to talk about these things as well. And Again, I want to let our listeners know that this program is heard every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 12 noon here on KIST, 1340 Progressive Talk, as we talk about the things that will give you choices and give you knowledge about, again, pursuing those areas in your life. And I have to say, Greg, that the information that you have shared with us today, and we are not quite finished with the program as of yet, but up to this point, it just sounds to me like, my gosh, we literally, if we can grasp the keys that you've shared with us today, if we can really use those, turn those in those locks and unlock those doors of belief that we've had for so many years, we literally could have whatever we wanted in our lives.
It changes everything, and I believe that once Western civilization really grasps the implication of what the new science is showing, our world will change forever. And I believe this is the generation where that's going to happen. And the reason I believe that is because of where we find ourselves today. Some of the best minds of our time are telling us that we're at this pivotal point in human history. It's called the bottleneck, where the resources are being taxed, our ability to solve the problems is being taxed. And they say we've got about 8 to 10 years to figure this out. To figure out how to solve our problems without war, to deal with the new diseases on the horizon, the possible global implications, to deal with abrupt climate change, all of these things happening right now. I think our technology has pushed us to the place where we've got to come full circle, Richard, and understand our role in the universe, write us back into the equation of the universe so that we can survive what it is that we've created, and this is the generation, I think, where that happens. So
indeed.
It's a very exciting time.
It is an exciting time. It doesn't have to be a time of fear and trepidation. I want to let our listeners know, too, that our upcoming guests for next week, we have the author of Life Prints, basically deciphering your life purpose from your fingerprints, kind of an interesting concept in and of itself. And then on the 29th, we're going to have Frederick Elias, I Can, I Will. He's a PhD here in Santa Barbara. Will be talking about basically taking the concepts you're talking about, maybe incorporating what we find out as our life purpose and going out and doing it and making it happen.
Please give Fred my very best when you talk to him and let him know I said thank you for his work.
All right. We'll definitely do that. I definitely will. Now, we have been, you and I have been interviewing and chatting for a number of years, and I remember it was the Elias Effect that I think was the original book that brought us together. And tell our listeners a little bit about the Elias Effect, because I know that's in the early stages of all of what we've talked about, but
The Isaiah Effect.
I'm sorry, Isaiah Effect.
That's because Mr. Elias is on our minds right now, so see how well the field works. The Isaiah Effect was actually it was written at the turn of the millennium. It was written in the late 90s, published in 2000, and it... it is a very reader-friendly book that talks about not only the application of the principles that we're talking about now, but a lot of case histories and in terms of how these things have played out and how we know that the field and the applications and the techniques work. And the bottom line to the Isaiah Effect, and also a subsequent book called Secrets of the Lost Mode of Prayer, is that there is a modality of speaking to this field. The ancients called it a form of prayer that has no words, no outward expression, and we've already discussed it here in the program. It is us feeling the feeling of gratitude and appreciation as if our prayers have already been answered in our hearts. It's not just a thought in our mind. It's not wishing or hoping or asking for intervention. You know, dear God, please let these things happen. It's not that kind of a prayer. It's a prayer that recognizes that we're part of all that we experience in our world, and because of that, we have the ability to bring the joy and the healing and the abundance into our lives personally. We don't need that intervention in this mode of prayer. So it's feeling as if the healing has already happened or the abundance is already there. And how is our life different now that it's already happened and coming from that place, so that we're giving the field the template or the blueprint to work from, allowing the field to mirror back to us in life what it is that we're claiming in our hearts. That in the last few moments, that's the bottom line to the book, The Isaiah Effect.
It's interesting because before I started doing these programs here in Santa Barbara, this this radio show, Tell Me Your Story, that I signed a contract to broadcast for some time to come, I certainly hope. I remember when I would get frustrated at other things, and then I would start thinking about the radio show, and my energy level and my excitement would go up because, oh man, I can hardly wait to get on the air and start talking with these people and sharing this information with the listeners and so on and so forth. And then suddenly, well, guess what? I'm here. Here we are, and it's you and me, Greg, and we're chatting, and I've got other guests down the road, and we're going to be talking about similar issues and topics and subjects. And having a great deal of fun doing so, and so I don't know whether that's a great example. Maybe that is of how this can work, where you, because I felt the exhilaration, the excitement.
Well, absolutely, and that tells you that for you, you are precisely where you need to be, and we're glad you are, Richard. And I'm glad to hear you sign that contract as well. But you know, it comes about in the books. I tell a number of stories. I tell of individuals with potentially life-threatening conditions, where those conditions are changed in less than 3 minutes, in the presence of people who understand this language and feel the feeling as if those people are healed, and their body mirrors that physical reality very quickly because the language is so clear. That's with one person. Then I also share the stories of when many people get together in a geographic area like the Middle East and feel the feeling of peace and how the peace happens, and that's all that happens while they're having those experiences documented in the Journal of Conflict Resolution, the International Peace Project in the Middle East during the Lebanese-Israeli War in the 1980s. Same principle. One is used for an individual. The other one is used for a broad geographic area. And it works for everything in between, whether it's our relationships, or you doing the radio program, or me leaving the corporations and becoming a full-time author. All of those begin with the seed of the miracle, and that seed is feeling the feeling. Not that it's only possible, but to some degree, we've got to be feeling the feeling as if it's already happened. And when you feel that exhilaration, that is you feeling as if you are already successful and if you are already doing what you're doing. And that's what opens the doors in this field for greater opportunities of those things to come into our lives.
Well, I have to say that it is an exciting thing to think about and begin the process of feeling about, that, again, we can literally change our lives, change our worlds, and it definitely is going to change our focus, and we can maybe minimize some of this terrible stuff that is happening in the world.
Richard, what it says to us is we know this, that this field, and by the way, it's so new, they've yet to decide on or determine a certain one name. Some people simply call it the field. Stephen Hawking calls it the mind of God. Former Apollo astronaut Ed Mitchell calls it nature's mind. Max Planck called it the matrix. We're calling it the divine matrix. All different names for the same field.
Yeah.
What we know is that it's the container for everything in the universe, and that means that the leaders of all those great nations on this earth are in the same field that we are, and that we all have a vote, we all have a voice in what happens in this reality if we understand the language that it takes to cast that vote. And I think that's what programs like this are helping us to come to terms with.
Well, I certainly hope that people are certainly listening more actively than passively, but I've also believed, too, that whether you're listening actively or passively, it's like if you're listening at all, the word goes in. The information, it's like on a computer hard drive, as you well know, the information is never actually lost, at least up to a point. It has to be overwritten a number of times, but if it's just deleted one time, that information's still there. It's just that you don't have it in the table of contents anymore. So
right.
It's like it's there, and one day you're going to go, you know, I heard something way back when about this divine matrix thing, and this sounds similar to that, and suddenly the thoughts begin to spin, and the next thing you know, they're doing stuff in their world they never thought they'd be doing. And that's what we want to do with this program is help people to reach that level of understanding themselves and the world around them, and even the world they can't see, which is really what we're talking about here with this field, this divine matrix, and begin to utilize it again for the purpose that they were put here for, if they believe that, or the purpose that they want to accomplish, the things that they want to do in their lives, and that they were maybe, I don't know, designed to do. That kind of brings a whole new realm into this. Was there a divine planner that kind of put all this together? Is there a choice that we really have, or is this all a play that we're just kind of acting out for somebody else's, I don't know, enjoyment? I mean, these are other questions that we'll have to save for another time. I want to remind our listeners, Greg Braden's been my guest here on Tell Me Your Story. His website, gregbraden.com. That's gregbraden.com. You can get there by going to my website, richarddugan.com. I have a link to his website as well as to this interview that you'll be able to listen to on future dates as well. And Greg, I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure having you, and I look forward again to having you when you get back from your tours and do get this book out that is going to be called The Spontaneous Healing of Beliefs, and look forward to having you back then.
I look forward to that. Thank you for being such a gracious host, Richard. God bless you and all of our listeners.
Thank you. And Greg, stay on the line. I want to chat with you just a moment. I'm Richard Dugan, and I want to thank you for joining us. If you'd like to get more information about our program, go to richarddugan.com and join us. I'd love to have you do that. And thank you for joining us here on this program. Have yourselves a great afternoon.